Chapter 19. Nowhere to Hide. By Friday, my body had been on triple intravenous antibiotics for 4 full days, but still wasn't responding. Family and friends had come from all over, and those who hadn't come had initiated prayer groups at their churches. My sister-in-law, Peggy, and Holly's close friend, Sylvia, arrived that afternoon. Holly greeted them with as cheerful a face as she could muster. Betsy and Phyllis continued to champion the "he's going to be fine" view, to remain positive at all costs. But each day it got harder to believe. Even Betsy herself began to wonder if her no negativity in the room order really meant something more like no reality in the room. "Do you think Evan would do this for us if the roles were reversed?" Phyllis asked Betsy that morning, after another largely sleepless night. "What do you mean?" asked Betsy. "I mean, do you think he'd be spending every minute with us, camping out in the ICU? Betsy had the most beautiful, simple answer, delivered as a question. "Is there anywhere else in the world where you can imagine being?" Both agreed that though I'd have been there in a second if needed, it was very, very hard to imagine me just sitting in one place for hours on end. It never felt like a chore or something that had to be done. It was where we belonged, Phyllis told me later. What was upsetting Sylvia the most were my hands and feet, which were beginning to curl up like leaves on a plant without water. This is normal with victims of stroke and coma, as the dominant muscles in the extremities start to contract. But it's never easy for family and loved ones to see. Looking at me, Sylvia kept telling herself to stay with her original gut feeling. But even for her, it was getting very, very hard. Holly had taken to blaming herself more and more. If only she had walked up the stairs sooner, if only this, if only that. And everyone worked especially hard to keep her away from the subject. By now, everyone knew that even if I did make a recovery, recovery wasn't much of a word for what it would amount to. I'd need at least 3 months of intensive rehabilitation, would have chronic speech problems if I had enough brain capacity to be able to speak at all, and I'd require chronic nursing care for the rest of my life. This was the best-case scenario, and as low and grim as that sounds, it was essentially in the realm of fantasy anyhow. The odds that I'd even be in that good of a shape were shrinking to non-existent. Bond had been kept from hearing the full details of my condition, but on Friday, at the hospital after school, he overheard one of my doctors outlining to Holly what she already knew. It was time to face the facts. There was little room for hope. That evening, when it was time for him to go home, Bond refused to leave my room. The regular drill was to allow only 2 people in my room at a time so that the doctors and nurses could work. Around 6 o'clock, Holly gently suggested that it was time to go home for the evening, but Bond wouldn't get up from his chair, just beneath his drawing of the battle between the white blood cell soldiers and the invading E. coli troops. "He doesn't know I'm here anyway," Bond said, in a tone half bitter and half pleading. "Why can't I just stay?" So for the rest of the evening, everyone took turns coming in one at a time so Bond could stay where he was. But the next morning, Saturday, Bond reversed his position. For the first time that week, when Holly stuck her head into his room to rouse him, he told her he didn't want to go to the hospital. "Why not?" Holly asked. "Because," Bond said, "I'm scared." It was an admission that spoke for everyone. Holly went back down to the kitchen for a few minutes. Then she tried again, asking him if he was sure he didn't want to go see his daddy. There was a long pause as he stared at her. "Okay," he agreed finally. Saturday passed with the ongoing vigil around my bed and the hopeful conversations between family and doctors. It all seemed like a half-hearted attempt to keep hope alive. Everyone's reserves were more empty than they'd been the day before. On Saturday night, after taking our mother, Betty, back to her hotel room, Phyllis stopped by our house. It was pitch dark, with not a light in a window, and as she slogged through the soaking mud, it was hard for her to keep to the flagstones. By now it had been raining for 5 days straight, ever since the afternoon of my entrance into the ICU. Relentless rain like this was very unusual for the highlands of Virginia, where in November it is usually crisp, clear, and sunny, like the previous Sunday, the last day before my attack. Now that day seemed so long ago, and it felt like the sky had always been spewing rain. When would it ever stop? Phyllis unlocked the door and switched on the lights. Since the beginning of the week, people had been coming by and dropping off food, and though the food was still coming in, the half-hopeful, half-worried atmosphere of rallying for a temporary emergency had turned darker and more desperate. Our friends, like our family, knew that the time of any hope for me at all was nearing its end. For a second, Phyllis thought of lighting a fire, but right on the heels of that thought came another unwelcome one. Why bother? She suddenly felt more exhausted and depressed than she could ever remember feeling. She lay down on the couch in the wood-paneled study and fell into a deep sleep. Half an hour later, Sylvia and Peggy returned, tiptoeing by the study when they saw Phyllis collapse there. Sylvia went down to the basement and found that someone had left the freezer door open. Water was forming a puddle on the floor, and the food was starting to thaw, including several nice steaks. When Sylvia reported the basement flood situation to Peggy, they decided to make the most of it. They made calls to the rest of the family and a few friends and got to work. Peggy went out and picked up some more side dishes, and they whipped up an impromptu feast. Soon, Betsy, her daughter Kate, and her husband Robbie joined them, along with Bond. There was a lot of nervous chatter and a lot of dancing around the subject on everyone's mind, that I, the absent guest of honor, would most likely never return to this house again. Holly had returned to the hospital to continue the endless vigil. She sat by my bed, holding my hand, and kept repeating the mantras suggested by Susan Wrenches, forcing herself to stay with the meaning of the words as she said them and to believe in her heart that they were true. Receive the prayers. You have healed others. Now is your time to be healed. You are loved by many. Your body knows what to do. It is not yet your time to die.